And the first item on the agenda will be Senator Ingebrigtsen with the Senate File 1115. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, this is the Aquatic Invasive Species Bill. Joining me at the table are representatives from the DNR that will take you through the bill. I do also, although I want to start out with a delete all amendment, and that would be the A3 amendment. I think you all have it in your packet. If not, it'll be handed out.
And would you go ahead and describe the amendment, Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Actually, Mr. Chair and members, it's just a rework of the document, if you will, and I'll have Mr. Knopf explain it real quickly, if he would, as far as the amendment, and the other folks here can talk about the bill itself.
Well, Mr. Chairman, to start out, on line, it really it needs a technical amendment on the first page. On line 1.6, delete a conveyance and insert water-related equipment. So that's the term of art we're using here. So, or thermally or otherwise treat water-related equipment in order to remove or destroy aquatic invasive species as prescribed by the commissioner. That would make it consistent with the terminology in the remainder of the bill. And Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebrigtsen, I think I'd recommend that Major Smith go through this, and maybe I can point out and highlight some of the differences between the bill as originally proposed by the agency and what you'll find in this document.
Please do that. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Knopf. With that, we'll go ahead and make the do you want to make the amendment on the table here, Mr. Chair?
Yes. Senator Ingebrigtsen moves the A3 amendment.
As amended.
As amended. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. The amendment carries.
With that, Mr. Chair, I'll turn it over to the testifiers.
And would you state your name, gentlemen, for the record and your position, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Major Rodman Smith, Operations Manager for DNR Enforcement.
Luke Skinner, I supervise the Department of Natural Resources Invasive Species Program.
Mr. Chair, members, we'll do a walkthrough on this bill. There's several overreaching policy changes, and there's also a lot of technical changes. And so I'll briefly go over the technical changes and spend a little bit more time on some more of the policy changes. So starting off with Section 1, and actually Section 1 through Section 6 are just terminology changes. Section 1 is define the word decontaminate. Section 2 would define introduce, and basically what introduce is not include. Section 3 would be defining the word inspect, and you'll see that a little bit later on. Section 4 defines the term inspector. Section 5 defines the term service provider, and that'll be talked about later on as well. Section 6 talks about the definition of transport, and most importantly, what a transport does not include. Section 7 defines a new term of water-related equipment. So instead of doing a laundry list of a lot of different articles, we just have an overreaching term of water-related equipment. That's Section 7. Section 8 is having the definition of wild animal, giving the same definition under game and fish law, so that when we have words that are defined in different sections of law, they always have the same meaning, so we're not dealing with different definitions of the same word. Section 9 talks about an annual report by the DNR that's due to the legislature, and it just modifies that, as you can see in line 0.34 and line 0.35. Section 10 talks about bait harvested from infested waters. Part A talks and Part B talk mostly about diseased fish, waters that have VHS. And then Section C talks about, down on 3.19, talks about equipment authorized in designated infested water can't be used in any other waters unless it's specified in a permit. Section 11 talks about commercial fishing, and this mostly has to do, once again, with Lake Superior and some of the equipment requirements on Lake Superior. And then on the bottom of that section, when we get into line 0.419, this would be something new that maybe Mr. Knopf would want to talk about.
Mr. Chair and members.
Mr. Knapp.
Paragraph E was not part of the language suggested by the agency. What this would do, although it's my understanding it's common practice to do this now, but what this would do is put in the statutes that when you're harvesting aquatic life for the purpose of transporting stocking, that they have to transport it to a holding facility and remain for at least 10 hours to be examined for the presence of invasive species. The other thing that this does is in paragraph F, it says this whole subdivision, including the nets and all the equipment that has to be marked, and then also this holding facility would also apply to the state, its departments and agencies. Some of you probably don't know this, but generally, unless laws are explicitly say that they apply to the state or its state agencies, many times have been interpreted to not apply to state agencies. So this would make it abundantly clear that this applies to state agencies.
Thank you, Mr. Knopf. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Section 12 is also something that maybe Mr. Knopf would...
Yeah, Mr. Chair, what this does is it requires a person, and this, if they identify an aquatic invasive species that's in a location where it has not been known to exist, it requires them to report it immediately. In other words, but they'd have to know that the species exists and that it's not normally in that location to report it. And it does provide a process for them to report it to an inspector or a peace officer. And we'll get later on in the bill, it talks about how these inspectors are training for inspectors and that sort of thing and who these inspectors are.
Mr. Knopf, is there a penalty for somebody that doesn't report?
Mr. Chairman, yes, there would be. 84D.08. If you look actually later on in the bill, you will see criminal penalties on subdivision 3 on the top of page 9. It goes from 84D.03 to 84D.11, so 84D.08 will be in the middle of that. So it would be considered a crime. But again, I mean, if you're ignorant of what it is, this wouldn't apply. This only applies when you know it.
Right.
It's really kind of giving somebody a duty to do it.
Yeah.
But there would be penalties for not doing it. I mean, there is a criminal penalty, although proof of that would be probably difficult. And under the, I'm not sure if there are any civil penalties that have been associated with this. It may or may not be, but I'm not clear on that, but there certainly would be a criminal penalty that would apply.
Okay. I didn't want to necessarily get ahead of ourselves here. Major Rodman, you want to continue?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Moving along to Section 13.
Mr. Scoy.
I'm
Senator
sorry.
Scoy.
Before we leave this Section E, well, just, I don't know, maybe to Senator Ingebretson, or what are we trying to get at with this 10-hour holding time period? I mean, what's the issue that's... this is trying to fix?
Page 4. Mr. Chair, Senator Squire, you're talking about the quarantine of the 10-hour quarantine?
Yeah, the 10-hour quarantine.
Okay, what that's required now, the way I understand it, of the private fisheries, and we're just making sure that the DNR lives to the same standard.
Oh, Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebretson, so if you're a minnow harvester, you have to do this currently, and
yes.
We're having the DNR and their fish stocking efforts comply with the same rules?
Yes. That was the intent, Senator Squay.
Oh, thank you. That clears it up a lot.
Okay. Continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, continuing on, Section 13. Talks about aquatic macrophytes and the transportation of aquatic macrophytes, and the Strzokan language just it used to be that you couldn't transport aquatic macrophytes on public roads. The Strzokan language would show that you would not be able to transport aquatic macrophytes anywhere, not just limited to basically public roads or forest roads. And then there is an exception then on the back end of that section on line point 69 to 610 that exempts a person when they pull the boat out of the water. They can pull it out of the water and up under the access to then remove those from there. So section 14 is just technical changes on language about what aquatic plant harvesting or control equipment. So those are just very technical in nature. Section 15 talks about removal and confinement. Again, we're replacing a lot of that language with water-related equipment. That's very technical. And then getting into Part 4 under Subdivision 3 is a prohibition on placing water-related equipment into the state when there are aquatic macrophytes attached in violation of Subdivision 1 or when the drain plug has not been allowed or removed. And then there's some clarification on 6.30, 6.31 about an inspector. There is a difference in the definition of inspector between a licensed peace officer and conservation officer and somebody that's been trained as an inspector and what their responsibilities are. Section 16 is Section 16. Section 16 is the old, last year was what was called the drain plug law or pull the plug law, where when people had to remove their boat from the water, they actually had to remove the drain plug while it was being underway. And there's some, as you can see, technical changes on a lot of the license. A lot of the language on water related, and then I believe there was one change under line 7.9710. Mr. Knopf?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members, the big difference here is I think that the agency was going to start prohibiting portable bait containers. In the law last year, portable bait containers were still allowed to be taken off a lake with water intact. And this was, they were proposing to eliminate that. What this does is it eliminates it for everybody but licensed aquatic farms. So they would be able to take portable bait containers from the lake and transport them to their facilities. Again, they have to have the 10-hour holding facility. So this, it just would allow them to carry it with the water to their holding facility. The other difference here, I think, if I remember right, this is the section that the agency was asking to have themselves exempt from the requirement to remove the plugs, and that's not included here.
Mr. Chair, I believe they were just pointing that out. How would we handle that?
Well, Mr. Chair, they would be treated like everybody else and have to remove their plugs when they leave a body of water.
Can I comment on that?
Certainly, please.
Mr. Chair, actually, it was a exemption for emergency response equipment, which encompasses more than conservation officers. It would have encompassed sheriff's departments, fire departments, anybody that would do a waterborne or a water-based rescue or emergency operations. We heard some feedback from some of the county sheriffs and some of the fire departments that, you mean when our fire trucks run into a rescue, that not only we need to get all our stuff put in there, but we got to remember to put the drain plug in before we go out to try to rescue somebody. So the language we had was to, if an emergency vehicle, in this case a boat, would drain all their water and fulfill the requirements, that they could operate on the road with the drain plug in. So it was more broad than the agency. It was emergency vehicles.
Okay.
So
you want to continue on?
Certainly. Go ahead.
All right. Section 17 is where we get into the inspection of water-related equipment. Subdivision 1 talks about compliance inspections and that how folks, it's an express condition of operating or transporting water-related equipment that these folks need to be available and make their watercrafts or water-related equipment available to inspections. Subdivision 2 gets into the inspection authority. Gives a commissioner the authority to train and authorize people to do inspections. Part B under Subdivision 2 talks about how the inspectors can do the inspections, both visually and tactically. Some of these zebra mussel veligers can't be seen, but if you rub your hand along the hull of the boat, you can feel them. So we wanted to make sure that the tactile inspection was up front. And then we get into Subdivision, or Part C under Subdivision 2, that gets into a conservation officer or a licensed peace officer. If they see somebody stopped, so they're already stopped, so it wouldn't be somebody that's running down the road. If they're stopped, then there's reason to believe that they have some type of aquatic invasive species, that they could do an inspection at that time. And then part Part D, going over to page 8, point line 8.3, talks about how the conservation officers and peace officers may utilize check stations to inspect water-related equipment, and talks about how the check stations shall be operated in a manner that minimizes delays to vehicle equipment and the occupants. Section 18 talks about a service provider permit. This was something that the stakeholder group was very interested in, that helped us formulate this language. And the service provider is there's both a professional and a cottage industry out there of folks that will put in docks, take out docks, move docks from one lake to another, move boats from one lake to another. Those folks have identified invasive species, the discoveries for us, but they've also identified material or equipment that has an invasive species on it and has caught it for us. That's a segment of protection that we feel is very important. So we are going to have some permit requiring so that the owner of a business would have to go through and get a permit, and then anybody that works for that individual would also have to have some type of training associated with that permitting as well. And that's something that Mr. Knopf, you wanted to talk more about the permitting for the employees.
Yeah, Mr. Knopf. Mr. Chairman, one difference between what the department sent in and this is, if you look at the paragraph C on 8.18, it talks about persons working for a permittee must satisfactorily complete the aquatic invasive species training. The other thing I did want to point out, it's probably something we missed on page one, is there's another modification. The concern is that everybody who worked for somebody would have to would also have to be permitted as a service provider. There were some changes made that now it just says when it's for hire. So the first sentence before said for compensation, now it's for hire. And I put another sentence in that says service provider does not include a person working under the supervision of an individual with a valid service provider permit issued under that section. So we make it abundantly clear that it's only the owner of the business or whatever, the person who contracts with the landowner to install the dock, that sort of thing.
Major Rodden.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Section 19, it talks about kind of like we just discussed, but instead of lake service provider, we're talking about bait harvesters and folks that work for a bait harvester. They're not the actual permittee, but they're working for somebody who's a permittee, would have to go through some aquatic invasive species training. So Section 20 gets into criminal penalties and defines some of the new provisions that are in this bill that would be criminal penalties, but it also removes some provisions because of some of the way we change some of the definitions on some of the criminal penalties. So that's where the criminal penalty section is. Section 21 talks about warnings and civil citations, some very technical stuff, and then we get into under Section 21, I guess it would be line 9.21, it would be it's basically the pull-the-plug law that would be subject to a civil penalty. Section 22 actually gets into the civil penalties and the dollar amounts for the civil penalties.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
If I might ask the major to go through that a little bit with the committee, if you could, the warning and civil citation. Just go through the workings of that as a boater coming off the lake and not complying here, just so they have a little better idea as to what kind of enforcement we're talking about.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Senator Engelbrigtsen, where we get into this is it talks about after appropriate training, there's a number of folks designated by the commissioner who can either issue a warning or a citation. The persons who are either unlawfully transporting prohibited species, aquatic macrophytes, or unlawfully places water-related equipment in, intentionally damage or fails to provide some of these things. So we have a range of options in law enforcement to educate folks to get them where they need to be. You can utilize verbal warnings. We can utilize a written warning, which there's no fine involved. It's documentation that there was a violation and it's written and recorded. Then we have two other options. We'd have a criminal penalty, which would be something that would go on, would be a criminal violation, probably be most likely a misdemeanor in most cases related to this bill. It'd be something that would be on what's called the statewide payable list where they'd pay a fine. And then the other option we have is the civil penalties, and the civil penalties work a little different. The civil penalties have a dollar amount, and they're not part of a criminal record. You did violate the law. There's some burden of proof differences between a criminal and a civil citation, just like you do in criminal court or civil court. So there's differences there. So the officer, whether it's a conservation officer, a sheriff's deputy, a tribal police officer, whoever's working on this case or whatever this detail might be, they do have a range of options on what they can do, from verbal warning, written warning, criminal to civil.
And Mr. Chair, members, I think it's important to point out that this is something, obviously the invasive species is not something new to Minnesota, however the enforcement is. And I think it's an educational process, as well as having the option to have some meat in it, if you will, some skin in the game. If you're not going to pay attention, and if you're just going to go ahead and willfully disregard the laws here, it gives the enforcement officers something to do. But at the same time, being open to people just simply making mistakes and not knowing and not understanding. And it's going to be a process, I think, that is going to happen. It's going to take some time to do, and we'll talk a little bit later about where we rank as far as other states. I think it's important to know where we're at. But I wanted to stop there and just tell folks that we are serious about this, but at the same time, if some people are going to make some mistakes the first time around, they don't have to pay so severely. So thank you for that, if you want to move on.
Senator Saxhog.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I agree with Senator Ingebrigtsen. I think the what we're trying to do here initially is to get everybody's attention. You know, it's kind of like getting the donkey's attention. You got to whack them over the head, and then I think we'll make some real progress after that happens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Saxhog. I really appreciate that. I think we need to send certainly a strong message. We want to keep these invasives where they're at. We don't want them to spread to other lakes, and we're very serious about it. But the first horse out of the gate, if you will, here it is. You better pay attention, otherwise you're going to be paying dearly. So, we need to support our enforcement officers when they go that far. So, thank you.
Mr. Rodman.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Moving on, Section 22 is getting into the actual dollar amounts for the civil penalties, and you can see going through, the agency doubled that amount. There was a lot of talk in the stakeholder groups about where these dollar amounts should land, and the spectrum is quite wide, as you can imagine. And so the agency, to start the conversation, we simply went through and doubled them, and as policymakers, if you feel something different, then you feel something different. So the other change, other than doubling the dollar amounts, I guess the change of note would be down in line 10.16 to 10.18, where it talks about someone that has one or more prior convictions would be subject to twice the penalty amounts listed. So if you didn't get the message the first time, hopefully you'll get it the second time, because your fine is going to be a lot higher. But hopefully you won't even have to go to a second time. So, Section 23 is some technical changes to the watercraft license suspension. Section 24 talks about the satisfaction of civil penalties. Currently, when a civil citation is written for anything that has to do with aquatic invasive species, the fine amount goes into the aquatic invasive species account, which is an account here at the state that then the legislature would appropriate that money out. And with this change, what this would allow, and this had some recommendations from the stakeholder group, is to get other law enforcement agencies potentially involved in enforcing aquatic invasive species. For example, if a county sheriff's deputy wrote a civil citation for $500, that $500 wouldn't go into the aquatic invasive species account. That $500 would go to the issuing county. And so this isn't really breaking new ground. We've done this with the civil citations for trespass, I believe, where the sheriff's offices or the issuing agency can get that. All the money that a conservation officer would write for still would go into that aquatic invasive species account. But it's just a change for the local units of government. Moving on, Section 23 talks about receipts, some more technical changes. Section 26 is an aquatic invasive species rule decal. There was a lot, education is very key to this whole rule packet or this whole law package. And we had some discussions on how to get that done. Our stakeholders wanted it to be a requirement in order to get your boat registered, in order to pass an invasive species training, and that would have to be a requirement to pass that in order to get your boat registered. We talked with the Coast Guard. That would be in violation of Coast Guard rules. And so what we came up with was an alternative, and it worked well before, and we're going to try it again. And that was when we had, I guess some people might call them another invasive species on our lake back in the 90s, personal watercraft. We had a lot of issues with personal watercraft and the operation of personal watercraft. We kind of had some of these same conversations, but we realized that normally the owner of the watercraft wasn't the one going around in circles making all the problems. It was the operator. It was the brother-in-law, the kids, or whatever. So we came up with a rules decal that had to be in plain sight of the operator. And that went a long way for us. And so similar with aquatic invasive species, the registered owner of the boat isn't always going to be the one operating it. And so we figured we'd do something similar where we'd have a very brief list of some of the rules and some of the prevention methods that will be this size. I can see staff over there. It won't be this size. That would have to be in plain sight of the operator. So, and then there's another provision later on that talks about the enforcement of this. In fact, I can talk about it right now. Actually, Section 30, which is coming up here, it says that conservation officers or peace officers can only write written warnings for this for the first 2 years of enactment. So these are going to be available at every bait shop, every boat registration. County sheriff's deputies that are water patrol deputies, conservation officers will have these. We'll give them out. It'll be a great conversation starter, a great way to be one-on-one with somebody when they do bump a boat and talk to them about aquatic invasive species.
Senator Kozelka. Senator Kilash.
Yeah, he answered.
Okay. Yeah. Yes, Senator Gazelka.
Mr. Chair, is it possible you can send that sticker out? You know, we've got to get our tabs, or is there other ways to get it out to people besides hoping they're going to come to a place where they have them?
Mr. Chair, Senator, absolutely, yes. That's one of the things I should have mentioned. That we'd be mailing them out to registered owners, too, I believe. So.
Okay. Continue on.
Mr. Chair, I may have a question, something that's a bit of an oversight on my part. I might ask the major with regards to canoes and applying them on a canoe. I know in a motorboat situation where you're able to operate it, there's usually a dash or some kind of seat or something. Just give us an idea, because I know that question came up earlier.
Mr. Chair, Senator, it would be, as long as it's in plain view, so you could put it on the middle seat in front of you, you can put it on the inside, you could put it just about anywhere that it would stick, so that's in plain view of the operator.
Thank you.
Okay.
Section 27, if I may continue, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Mr. Rabbit, go ahead. Major.
Actually, Mr. Chair, this is something that's added in Senator Igbritson's amendment. What it is, it deals with a public waters work permit, and it right now, certain boards and groups can require a hearing for a public waters work permit, but for some reason for the municipality, it just says mayor, and so this would change that to governing body for the municipality rather than the mayor requiring or demanding the hearing on a public waters work permit. These are permits for changing the course, current, or cross section of the public water.
Okay. Major Rotman?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Almost done here. Section 28 has to deal with more of aquatic plants and the issuance of some permits, not super closely related to aquatic invasive species. Section 29, again, talks about invasive species plant management permits. has to do more with lakeside type of plantings.
Lakewide control.
Thank you. Section 30 is that temporary warning requirement for the decal that we had talked about. Then Section 31, if Mr. Knopf would go over that.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members, what that is it's asking for a report for long-term funding needed to implement and enforce Chapter 84D, basically the Invasive Species Act. So this is, you know, as we talked about in the budget earlier, we've got some one-time money for the next 2 years. And what this would do would ask for a report back to take a look at long-term funding needed to implement and enforce it, and what their needs are over the years.
Mr. Chair, if I might address that as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, as you remember, our finance bill did not include raising of fees, and that's exactly what we would be looking at after the one-time dollars have been put forward here. And that's how we fund this, actually, is the one-time. So those fees we're talking about are the portions of the boat fees as well as the out-of-state license fees. So that's something we'll be looking at, and we've been talking about that now, about fees over the last months here, but that's something that we definitely have to consider once these one-time dollars are gone. So,
Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Ingebretson, do you have any idea how much we may raise in fines that would go into this fund?
I defer that to Mr. Mueller.
Mr. Mueller. Chairman and members of the fiscal note being passed out right now, the actual doubling of all these fines, currently they must not be collecting much so far. It would only raise about another $4,000. That's probably, I think, a conservative estimate of going into the fund. The fiscal note also addresses a couple other issues, and I can go through that once we're done with the bill. But
okay. Page Rodman.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The second to last section here, Section 32, the repealer, 84D02 sub 4, is the old watercraft inspection language that talks about having 10,000 hours in volunteers. So that would be repealed with the new inspection language that we do have in this bill. That's the repealer. And then Section 33 would be the effective dates.
Mr. Knopf.
Mr. Chairman, the effective dates actually need to be adjusted, the section numbers. There was a section that was added at the beginning. So everything needs to move forward one. So it'd be on line 13, delete 16, insert 17, delete 18, insert 19, delete 24, insert 25, delete 26, insert 27, delete 31, insert 32. And because the key here is that everything's effective the day following enactment, except for the requirement to have the training or permit for those service providers and for the decal. So those all get delayed till August 1st under this, but the remainder of the bill would be effective the day following enactment. So we just need to change those numbers. They reflected an earlier version of this amendment.
Okay. Senator Ingebretson?
Mr. Chair, and to that point, members, it's interesting how effective dates are different from one committee to the other, or I guess from one area of law to the other, if you will. I just come from judiciary, Mr. Chair, and you were there with regards to a bill you're carrying that's put out actually until August, and there are some concerns whether how serious are we about this if we're going to postpone it until August. And I think that's a point to be made here, effective immediately. I think we're serious about this. We want this, hopefully, to pass through and get the governor's signature. And I know the governor's also made his staff has made comments about wanting to get this through before opening fishing. I mean, it's very important to do that. And we shouldn't be passing laws and say, well, it's a very important law to pass, but we're going to wait until August to put it into enforcement. Just so you know that most laws when they have sanctions, I understand, are usually for August, but we think it's important enough to do it immediately. So, just a comment,
Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure if this was for Major Smith or who it's for, but can you could you describe how the training process would work for the service providers, how we would, if the program's already put together, so as soon as this gets enacted, we've got dock installers that are going to be anxious within the next probably couple of weeks to start installing docks, and how that might all play out so we get kind of an idea.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, go ahead.
And Luke Skinner with the DNR. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we have currently been doing lake service provider trainings for over the last 3 years. We just put on two. Another one's going on tomorrow. And so we have it all dialed up right now on how to do it. It's about a 2 to 3 hour training with all the laws and regulations. They get a booklet on what to do. And if this passes through, they would actually then go to these trainings, be tested, and then they would get a certificate on the spot. So then they can move on and do their trainings. And this would be once every 3 years. Their staff would then have to be trained. And that's the part that we'd have to work out, figure out. Doesn't mean they have to get permitted, but we have to figure out a way to get them trained. It could be online training. It could be they come once and get trained again for a three-year period. The reason that we put that out to August is give us time to get those people trained and get them up to speed prior to the start. So it gives us a buffer to do that. The big issue is by this time, this goes in place now, is a lot of the docks and everything been put in. And that's not the real risk. The real risk is when they start to move stuff in the summer, and then especially when they pull out in the fall, what they do. So anytime we can get it, but by giving that buffer for a couple months, it gets us set up to be able to do the training and get it instituted like you suggested.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Ingebrigtsen, I'm looking at the initial bill introduced on language with regard to the emergency vehicles, and I was reading here that the emergency response vehicles may be transported on a public road with the drain plug or other similar device replaced only after all the water has been drained from the equipment upon leaving the water body. I don't care much about the DNR or the county sheriff when they're doing their fish checks or whatever, but if it's a airboat on a rescue, we probably don't want them having to stop and put the plug in. So I don't know exactly what kind of language we want to do for those emergency folks, but I think something like that ought to be included in this Section 16.
Mr. Chair.
Mr.
Senator Scoy, thank you for that. The House, in which they heard the bill today, does have that in here. Mr. Knopf, we talked about it in our previous meeting earlier today. Is there some way we can fix this orally now, or is there some type of a – do have a copy of that bill if you'd like. If Senator Scoy would like to offer that as an amendment. It is about a two and a half sentences here if you'd like. I agree. I don't know that we could stop that from happening when it's life and death.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Senator Knopf, let's go ahead.
Yeah, Senator Ingebrigtsen, if you have language that Major Smith thinks works, I'd be happy to offer it if somebody wants to read it. But I just think that, you know, for the emergency response vehicle, you know, once they've drained the water, they should be able to put the plug in. They're ready to go.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Scoy.
I think maybe, Mr. Knopf, if you would want to go to the original bill on line 6, page 21, or page 6, line 21 through 23, mm-hmm. We could reinstate that language in the amended version of the bill or whatever it is now.
Mr. Knopf.
Chairman, Senator Scoy, if you wanted to just modify it slightly to get at the issue you were talking about, you could say emergency response vehicles and equipment that are responding to an emergency.
Sure.
Or that are used in responding to an emergency. Would then, I think, get at your issue.
Okay, I would move that language as presented by Mr. Knopf.
Okay, it's been moved by Senator Skoy. The language that was presented by Senator, by Mr. Knopf. You want to read that again, Mr. Knopf?
Yeah, it would be on line 6.21 of the original bill. So what you're going to do is you're going to adopt a new paragraph. It's if you look at the bill as introduced, it's line 6.21 to 6.23. And you would be adding that to the appropriate location in the bill. We'll fit it in. And then it would say, you would add after the word equipment on line 6.21 that are used in responding to an emergency.
Senator Ingebretson, you're in.
Yes. Okay, that would be, that'd be a good amendment. Thank you.
Okay. Any discussion on that amendment? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed, nay? The ayes have it. The amendment is passed. Going on. Who's next? Questions for Major Smith?
Mr. Chair, if I could have the invasive species specialist, Mr. Skinner, comment with regards to how we fare out with this bill versus other states that he's familiar with and give you a little idea if you may have some questions of me.
Mr. Skinner.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in 1990, Minnesota adopted the first invasive species program in the country, and it was really aimed at two major things. That's prevention, try to prevent the spread of invasive species in the state, and management of those species that are already established here. And over time, we've adopted regulations requiring make it illegal to transport prohibited invasive species such as Eurasian water milfoil, zebra mussels, et cetera, aquatic plants, transport of water, and all these. We also adopted through the legislature an inspection program that now we're trying to revise and upgrade. So all these things were really new at the time. And over time, many states have adopted something similar to Minnesota. The change has occurred in the last 5 years where some of the western states have adopted more rigorous standards. Some of the states such as Wyoming, Colorado, and Idaho now require inspections of nearly all boats that are coming into the state and that are going to be launched onto lakes. And so they have much more restrictive policies there requiring this inspection and decontamination if they find to be infested or of high risk. By changing this law and giving us more authority to be able to do these inspections and be able to stop boats and not allow them to launch if they're infested or if they refuse to be inspected is a big step up. It doesn't get us to the same level where Colorado and some of the states are here, but it brings us up much closer to where we were now. Compared to other Midwestern states, this is far beyond what any other Midwestern state has currently. The closest state to us right now is Wisconsin. They have very similar laws about transport laws and requirements to drain water, but they do not have the required inspections as we are proposing here today. So this is more of a challenge and more restrictive than we currently have, but it's definitely necessary if we really want to prevent the spread. So it's about changing people's behavior, as we just talked about, and changing people's behavior and be able to inspect those and really try to reduce that risk through inspection and decontamination where necessary.
Members, any questions for Mr. Skinner? Seeing none, let's move on to other testifiers.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Forrester, if you're here. Welcome, Mr. Forrester. Identify yourself and continue on, if you would, with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Forrester, and I'm the Executive Director of Minnesota Seasonal Recreational Property Owners Coalition. So we represent the 122,000 people in the state that own cabins and hunting lands, a lot of whom own shoreline, live on lakes. And I suppose, you know, this bill for us is wonderful because we've been seeing it, you know, living on the lakes, people living on the lakes have been seeing the changes in the lakes over a period of years. We're kind of like the canary in the coal mine. We sort of see, you know, we remember what it was. We see how it's changed. And this bill, I think, are very good, has some very good first steps in it. We recognize that this is going to be a process, and we're anxious to continue working on this issue in the future. But we think that this is very good because the three main components for a program that we looked at in other states, Mr. Skinner talked about Utah, Colorado, and Wyoming. It's inspection, decontamination, and enforcement. Those seem to be the three kind of markers that the states that are really getting some success with these programs have in common. And there are those who say that we can't stop AIS, that no matter what we do, we won't be able to stop it. I don't know that that's true. I do know that we haven't tried yet, that we haven't really been aggressive, that we haven't really made a commitment as a state. The way we made a commitment with chronic wasting disease or one of these issues where we were very aggressive and we sought success and achieved success. People are, you know, really the bottom line here is people are going to have to change their behavior. We're all going to have to change the way we interact with our lakes and the way we move from lake to lake to lake. But this is like so many issues that come up where, you know, people have changed their behavior and we've gotten great results. For instance, the seatbelt laws. You know, I heard on the radio that we had the lowest death rate on our highways since the 1940s last year. So we can be successful if we're committed to it. And we believe that this bill is an excellent first step. And we're grateful to the chair of the committee for bringing it forward.
Thank you, Mr. Forrester. Any questions for Mr. Forrester? Great. Thank you. Seeing none, Dennis Peterson, if he's here. Dennis Peterson? No. Dave Zentner. Welcome to the committee. Go ahead, identify
Thank
yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Dave Zentner, and I'm a Duluthian, and spent much of my life as an outdoors person and a conservation volunteer. And I was thinking as I was coming down this morning that when I was just out of UMD and into my private business, we spent much time on the devastation in the Great Lakes by the sea lamprey, and have since invested millions of dollars trying to reestablish lake trout populations. And with the exception of Lake Superior, we've largely been unsuccessful. Also decimated at that time were plentiful whitefish populations. The ripple effect economically, loss of jobs, loss of vitality of the tourism industry was deeply felt, and we're still paying for it. We face that and more now in our interior lake system in the state of Minnesota. I participated in the stakeholder process led by the DNR in the past several months, and we're looking at-risk assets in terms of jobs relating to fishing alone in the thousands of jobs, 30 to 40,000 jobs that depend upon fishing in our state. In terms of total economic exchanges, dollars in the billions, our way of life, the lifestyle in this citizenry. So I'm here to urge you, I'm here to tell you that I fully support the proposition before you as a beginning, not as an end, but as a beginning to keep the energy going that we've begun to build. The ice is about to go out. The lakes are getting ready. The boats are getting ready to go in the lakes. And I would urge you, as others have done before me, to pass this as soon as is possible. I don't want to repeat a lot of other comments, Mr. Chairman, but I'll be glad to respond to questions that I might be able to respond to.
Any questions, members of Mr. Zentner? Okay. Thank you so much.
Mr. Chair, I don't have a question, but I have a comment. I visited with Mr. Zentner some month ago probably, and the guy sitting next to me has got his heart in this, believe me. He's been around a long time. He told the story of how they did actually battle the lamprey on the Great Lakes, and it was astounding and amazing to me. These are the kinds of folks that we should all be able to draw from and should draw from for our expertise when we start looking at resolving Minnesota problems. And here's a prime example of that. And I really thank him for the amount of work that he's done in the past. And we'll work in the future. And I'm sure you'll be here for, like you say, this is just a start. And I look forward to working with you as well as Mr. Forrester and getting the report back as to how this does work, and if we need to tweak it, which I'm sure we will, we'll look forward to working with you. So thank you for your service.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you very much. Mr. Chairman, one 30-second story. In 1986, I went with my best fishing pal to Iceland to fish for Atlantic salmon. 1986, the little country of Iceland. Before we could take anything associated with fishing off of the airplane, after we landed, we had to have previously have certified that every piece of equipment we brought into Iceland had been treated in a radiology department and certified at a hospital before that gear went on an airplane. So there you go. We got to get aggressive. Thank you very much.
There you go. Thank you, Mr. Zentner, again, and thank you for your service. Mr. Ness. Welcome to the committee. Identify yourself and continue if you would, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Lance Ness. I'm the president of the Fish and Wildlife Legislative Alliance and the president of Anglers for Habitat. First of all, I'd like to thank Senator Engelbertson, Senator Saxhog for bringing this bill forward. This is vitally important to sportsmen and anglers, and we take this issue very seriously. Our group, Anglers for Habitat, has even taken steps that in the next year we're going to try to an attempt to raise $500,000 to a public awareness campaign. You heard from some of the other testifiers, we have to get what we call learned behavior going here. Change the way we've done things. Just like putting on your seatbelt. When I get into my car now, the kids got the seatbelt on before I do. It's that quick. And we've just got to get people to change the way they operate. They've got to learn to clean their boats, get rid of these aquatic vegetation, make sure they're not transport water around that can possibly carry these microscopic and invasive species or diseases. And so we're gonna join forces as best we can, try to get a huge public awareness campaign, media, get people to change their way of thinking about this. Or they're going to face dire consequences. There are people I've talked to that would, you know, just soon close public accesses right now, quarantine lakes, shut them down, let's not have any possibility of this stuff transporting. As has been talked about, this is the start. This is not the end. But again, it's going to take a while to get people to change their behavior, but we're going to make our best effort. So we want you to know that.
Good. Thank you.
We support the bill, and thanks, Senator Ingebrigtsen, again. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ness. Any questions for Mr. Ness? Okay, thank you so much. Is there any other public testimony here? Anybody like to speak on behalf or against the bill? Hearing none. Members, do you have any other questions for Senator Ingebrigtsen? Mr. Knopf?
Mr. Chairman, I mentioned earlier that the effective dates need to be fixed. I think it would be best if you did that by amendment. Since this has already been adopted, I mean, it is a technical to make it work, but it's line 13.13 on page 13, and it would be to move 16, 18, 24, 26, and 31 up by one number each. I won't go through all of that, but I did earlier. If somebody could just move that and then adopt it.
Senator Gazelka moves that. Any questions or discussion? Hearing none, all in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The ayes have it. And amended. Any other questions, members? Senator Ingebrigts.
With that, Mr. Chair and members, I would move Senate File 115 as amended, to pass and
refer to
Judiciary and Public Safety.
Okay. All in favor? Say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The ayes have it. The Senate File 115 passes as amended.
Mr. Chair, thank you, members. The next bill that I have before the committee is the, and I'll ask the DNR to come up, representative from the DNR, and that is the Game and Fish Omnibus Bill. Me today is a couple of members from the DNR. And Mr. Johannes. So with that, members, this is the Oh, it's certainly not. It doesn't mirror last year's Game and Fish bill, but it's somewhat similar with some minor changes to it. And with that, I think what I'll do is start out with an amendment. I do have an author's amendment. It's an A3 amendment, Mr. Chair. I'd like to offer it at this time, and I'd have Mr. Knopf explain that amendment, if I could.
Mr. Knopf.
Mr. Chair, this and members, this deletes a number of sections within the bill and also replaces a few of the sections. I'll just go through each one to make sure you know what's not in the bill. On page 7, you can see that sections 12 and 14 are being deleted. That's dealing with the swine, releasing swine from captivity. And then on page 8, we're replacing the undressed bird definition with the one that's in the amendment. So that's section 16 is being replaced. And then also for the wild animal definition on section 18, you see that line 1.15 of the amendment. What that is doing is making sure that the wild animal definition is effective the day following enactment. So it matches with the aquatic invasive species bill change to wild animal in that chapter. So they'll both be effective the day following enactment. And then on page 10, you'll see section 21 is being deleted. And that has to do with the acquisition procedure for WMAs, so we're not making changes in that. On page 13, you've got section 31 that's being amended in this amended. And that deals with, that was to set a separate fee for taking sandhill cranes. And so those sections are being deleted. There will not be a separate license for taking of sandhill cranes in this bill. And then, Mr. Chair and members, you go to page 16, section 38. And we have an amendment there to take out, this is the scopes on for muzzleloaders. Since the Senate's already passed something different than this, it's being removed from this bill because it would conflict with what's already passed. Section 39 is being replaced. If you see on page 1 of the amendment on 1.21, it's being replaced. So just to clarify what it means, what we're trying to do here, if you look on page 2 of the amendment, on 2.7 to 2.11, to be clear that a person with a valid license to take deer by hunting during muzzleloader season may not take a firearm other than, so now we're specifying what the exceptions are, and that is a muzzleloader, number one, and number two is a handgun. That's providing clause A, 4 or 5, so it's basically handguns for a person who's authorized to carry under the concealed carry law. And that clarifies that. Then also there's a section being added here on 2.13 of the amendment. We're adding a section that also allows somebody with a concealed carry permit to carry a weapon while taking deer by archery. And then in section 40, then we're also deleting on page 20, deleting sections 44 and 47, and those are sections dealing with bear hunt. The first one is bear hunters. There was already a provision in Senator Saxhog's bill that was picked up by Senator. It passed in the funding bill, section 44, and this would actually conflict with that. So section 44 is being deleted, and then also on the bottom of page 20 of the bill, the sandhill crane license required. Is being deleted from the bill. And then, Mr. Chairman, there is a new section added here on section 44 on the amendment starting on 2.20. It's a fishing tournament organizers shall take preventive measures to reduce the spread of invasive species as defined in sections 84.01 subdivision 9A. So that's going to be part of the fishing tournament statutes. And then there's a new, and then also on section page 24, we're deleting section 54, and that deals with the agency doesn't want to decided not to do this now, where we're going to require a charter boat guide to, or anybody basically guiding anglers would have to have a license under this provision statewide. So we'll delete that, so it'll just stay in Lake Superior and the St. Louis River estuary. And then Mr. Chair and members, we're adding a new section 48, and what this has to do with is the walk-in program. As I understand it, that the Board of Water and Soil Resources weren't sure they had clear authority for their duties under the walk-in access program because they work with the U.S. Department of Agriculture on this. So this would give them that clear authority. You'll see on page 3 of the amendment on lines 3.24 to 3.31, giving them that clear authority. And then I think the last change on the amendment, well, I guess there's one little one after, is section 49. You'll see on what this does is it deletes the provision that's in there now on page 24 on the state walk-in access program. That's amending chapter 604A and deals with the liability. And what this does is it clearly states on 4.14 of the amendment to 4.15 that land leased to the state or otherwise subject to an agreement or contract for purposes of state-sponsored walk-in access programs. That exempts them or basically treats them the same as liability for a person who is just granting free access to their land. And then there are a couple of little changes. One is to there was an inappropriate reference in the rulemaking on page 25 of the amendment, and then also the other provisions dealing with elk stands and moose stands is being deleted. The Senate already dealt with that in its funding bill, so anything then that conflicts or does similar items is being removed from this bill. That's the amendment, Mr. Chair and members.
Okay. Any questions on the amendment?
It's an author's amendment.
Okay. Mr. Chair, with that, I'd move the amendment.
Okay. Senator Ingebrigtsen moves the amendment. All in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The amendment is moved.
Mr. Chair, with that, and members, I'll have Mr. Don Carlos go through the bill real quickly and stand for questions.
Mr. Don Carlos.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, excuse me, Senator Dames, please.
Mr. Chair, I do have the A6 amendment. Maybe we should look at that before we go forward.
I'm sorry.
Has the A6 amendment been passed out?
All right. Yeah, let's pass it on.
Well, the A6 amendment's being passed out. I'll just talk about the amendment. It's a coyote conflict management option, which would allow the county or town boards may by resolution offer a bounty for taking of coyotes by legal methods. The resolution may be applicable to the whole or any part of the county or town. The bounty must be during the month specified in the resolution and be in the amount determined by the boards. The effective date, this section would be effective following the date of final enactment.
Members, any discussion on the amendment A6?
Mr. Chair, if I might...
Senator
Dames, just to clarify, so this gives the counties or the townships, is that right?
The counties and townships.
The option to do
the
this.
The option or the authority to have a bounty for taking a coyote.
Okay, and in your discussion, Mr. Chair and Senator Dames, in your discussion with those folks, counties and townships, have they been talking about a dollar figure at all per animal?
That was not discussed.
Thank you.
Any more discussion on the A3 amendment? Sorry, A6 amendment. Hearing none. Senator Kelash?
I just wanted to make a point that this is the Kubley bill that we heard earlier. So.
Right. Okay. Hearing none. All in favor of accepting the A6 amendment, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. The amendment is passed. Now, let's go. Yes, Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Ingebrigtsen, I've talked to you about a couple of amendments. Would it be better to talk about those later or now?
I apologize. Let's do the amendments right away. Is that all right?
That's fine. My counsel's giving me. That's fine.
Yeah.
Yes. I have two amendments, but I'd like to move the A4 amendment.
Okay.
I'll wait for everybody to get that.
Yeah, why don't you wait a second?
In fact, I can explain it while it's being handed out. It's very, very simple. We had discussion last time we met here about gray wolves and delisting them. And this language, you'll see it when you get it, but it basically says that if there is an open season, there shall there shall be no open season for gray wolves until after the gray wolf is delisted. That's what the new language would say. It presently says there won't be a season for 5 years. So I'm just giving the DNR the ability to move on it as quickly as they see fit.
Okay, any discussion on the A4 amendment? Give you a second to look it over.
No comments, I guess.
Senator Saxon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Gasalka, so I'm trying to remember what we heard the other day. So how many years is it? Let's just say that we contemplated that, or was the delisting happened this year, then how many years automatically does it?
Senator Gasalka.
Mr. Chair, Senator Saxog, as I understood it, it could go on for five more years, or wait for five more years, and we already have plenty of data now, and I just want to give them the ability, if they want to move on it for next year, then they can do that.
Any other questions on the A4 amendment? Hearing none. All in favor of the A4 amendment, say aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. The ayes have it. The A4 amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Gasalka.
I have one more amendment, the A5, and this will be more controversial.
Okay, let's pass that out. Give people a second to read it.
While that's being handed out, Mr. Chair, if I may.
Go ahead, Senator Gasalka.
I was approached the private fisheries industry to carry this legislation. I thought it made more sense to have it in this game and fish bill as discussion went forward. The DNR, Mr. Meyer, really has only had today to take a look at it. So I would like to have his comments as well as the private industry. But in a nutshell, basically there's language change in here that for the walleye stamp, revenue from the walleye stamp must be credited to the walleye stamp account. Money in that account must be used only for stocking walleye purchased from the private sector in waters of the state, period. So there's more than that, but I really want to give the opportunity for the people that are interested about this to comment and for the DNR to comment.
Okay. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Mr. Chair, and I also do have a testifier from the private sector here that would testify after the DNR makes their comments.
Okay. Well, let's deal with the A5 amendment first, and if we have testifiers for them.
Would you like to comment first before we do it?
Sure, I'd be glad.
Yeah, I think we should do that. We should vet it a little bit.
Okay.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Roy Johannes. I'm with the Division of Fish and Wildlife, Section of Fisheries. And being involved and looking at this very quickly, I would just like to offer the DNR has some concerns right now with the language as it is, because we haven't had time to really look at it. But we do have a really good mechanism that we've worked with the private sector over the last few years in exchanging fry and eggs with them over a number of years. And we've also worked with them as far as a payment in kind program in the late 80s dealing with the price of game fish and eggs. So I'll leave it at that.
Okay. Thank you. Is there anyone else or any questions for him, Mr. Johannes? Yes, Senator Kielash.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Johannes, are we currently buying these eggs from the private sector? And if so, are we also harvesting eggs from the in the spring out of our own fisheries?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gerlach, our program currently is fairly large. Minnesota has the largest spawn-taking operations for walleye in the country. Currently, we take about 600 million eggs for walleye production around the state. Primarily, we have eight runs, which are right now at what we would call a maximum operation. The key ones that we have are two largest ones, the Cutfoot Sioux operation. We work cooperatively with the Leech Lake Band, where we provide them a portion of our egg take up there, and they provide a service to do that. Our second largest egg take is the Vermilion Run, and right now we are maxing that run out, where we work with a percentage return for the stocking of Lake Vermilion. The other runs, we have a commitment right now, a mandate for Leech Lake, our restoration program there, where we were stocking 23 million fry in 2011, and our Woman Lake egg take is dedicated just for that, and we dedicate one hatchery as well. We also have egg takes at Detroit Lakes, the Lake Sally run, and we have the Otter Tail run, as well as Pine River and so on. So right now, we take about 4,500 quarts of eggs, and that entitles about 600 million walleye eggs, and we have a commitment for stocking fry and for our ponds, as well as working with the private sector and doing an exchange to help them out get the proper strain for our contracts that we have with them.
Mr. Chair, are we purchasing eggs from the private sector?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Garlick, no, not at this time. We do an exchange.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Johannes, would this have a cost to the state then, this amendment? If we're going to go from doing an exchange to being required to purchase?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Higgins, we would have to do some analysis on that. We just had an opportunity to review this particular language and so on. And just on the onset, I would say it does have some impact on our operations, because currently right now we do have a priority on how we can dispose of eggs, and it's basically by surplus. And this would change how those values would go. Also, currently in language, it allows us to sell 2% of our egg takes as it now stands.
Other questions? Hearing none, do we have...
I do.
I'm sorry, Senator Kielash.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure the point of this. If we already have a surplus, why would we put into law that we need to purchase eggs from the private sector?
We have a testifier.
Testifier can answer that. Okay, thanks.
I'll have the testifier come up. That's
right. Yep, thank you.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Jim Bozek, and I'm a member of the Minnesota Fish and Bait Farmers. For the last 11 years, there's been an accelerated walleye program in the state. And the goal was to establish a recurring relationship with the DNR and the private growers. The three main points were to prove that the private fish farmers could raise the fingerlings required, provide a quality fingerling, and be cost effective. And in the last 11 years, we've been able to prove all them points. What we're at right now is we went from 4,000 pounds back in 2000 to the last couple of years. We're at 63,000 the year before and 56,000 pounds of fingerlings. The private growers have sold to the state of Minnesota. We're not asking to sell eggs to the state of Minnesota. What's happening as the fingerling program is being privatized, more and more of the fish that are being stocked into Minnesota are being stocked by the private sector. We're concerned about making sure that we get the proper genetics, from the different egg runs that the state is talking about, and that, the requirements, that are there are put in place early in the game here so we can move forward with privatization. I've been in discussions with the state here, Fisheries Department, January, February, and March, and these three points that were brought up about the egg take and stuff were discussed, and we talked about what it would take to change it, and we brought these ideals to you today as our recommendation to make the privatization move more thoroughly and more, in a cost-effective way, making sure that us as growers have the fry and the eggs available with the proper genetics to make sure we are able to take care of the state's needs throughout Minnesota. So that's why we're here today, and just make sure that, you know, right now there is a few points in the laws here that would limit us to the growth of the industry, you know, moving it toward privatization. Right now we're only allowed to get 2% of fry or eggs from the state of Minnesota. And as we're taking over more of the stocking of Minnesota lakes, the DNR is actually going to be gearing down. So they're not going to need the fry and eggs that they already are taking today. We're just trying to get that transferred over to the private sector so we can continue to gear up our fingerling program to make sure that the fish that we are supplying are the right genetics and the right quality. And right now, you know, the state's program for the last 11 years has been averaging around 60,000 fingerlings per year under their program, and then the rest has been made up with yearlings and adults. And it's, you know, it's a million less fingerlings in the lakes every year by the program that the DNR is going by in place for 11 years now. And we've proven to the state of Minnesota that the private sector is ready to take over the stocking program for our Minnesota lakes, and we just got to be allowed to do that. And it does take some language in the laws to make sure that does take place. I thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bozick. Yes, Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I contacted some fishing legends, Al Linder and Jim Kolkoven from used to be part of In Fisherman, just to see what their perspective was. And they said as long as there's DNR oversight, this is the right way to go. It's less expensive. But I think the testifier should clarify stocking as far as using fingerlings versus yearlings and the fact that you have far more fish being put into a lake if you're using all fingerlings.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members, we're required by law to sell the state of Minnesota a fingerling walleye, and that walleye is a 5-month-old fry to fingerling growth rate, which is around a 4 to 8 inch walleye. That walleye usually averages around 20 to the pound, and 20 to the pound is been considered the best cost-effective stocking program in Minnesota today. The DNR's ability to produce a fingerling walleye like that is non-existent. They're only able to do half of what is required of the state's needs today. The rest is made up with a one-year-old up to 5, 6, 7-year-old fish. You know, their program right now, they're stocking 5-pound fish, you know, 2-pound fish, 4-to-the-pound fish. You know, so the same value that they put on a pound of fish that they're buying from the private sector at $16 a pound, they're charging the taxpayers $23 a pound to produce adult walleyes, you know, for stocking purposes. And then in the 2000 records of fingerling to fingerling comparison, our fish are costing the state $16. The state's costs are $57 a pound. You know, so I mean, it's a really big cost savings to the state, but you're also getting the numbers, and it's a numbers game. You know, I mean, we can stock a few 1-pound fish, or we can buy them from the private sector and stock 20 times that number for the same or for a lot less money.
Good, thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Bozick? Yes, Senator Sachs.
Thank you. To the witness, I apologize for not catching your name. So the DNR would still collect the eggs at their fisheries, and then they would transfer those quarts or gallons of eggs to you, and you would raise them into the fingerling 4 or 5 month age category, and then they would be put into the lake in the summertime. Am I following that?
Right. You're correct, Mr. Chair and members. Yeah, it's we're just taking over the fingerling portion of it to stock Minnesota lakes, not the fry and egg take. Our concern is, you know, like Roy Johannes testified, the state has the eggs and fry available. You know, we don't have that access. We have to aerate ponds that normally would freeze out to try to keep our brood stock there. And for every genetic, we'd be required to have a different pond tied up out there in the wild, you know, with aeration systems and everything else in them to try to meet them needs. You know, we're trying to get away from the extra aeration systems, the extra time it takes to do that. And we brought up working with the DNR on them walleye runs, you know, to help cut the cost down, where we'd actually go out and work with the DNR and strip the walleyes and then be able to purchase them for their costs, you know, to, you know, if we're able to get them for their costs, then we're able to pass that on to the, you know, the public, you know, the taxpayers would be able to save money by, you know, us being able to cut the costs all the way around for the fry part of the program.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And to Mr. Myers, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Myers, is there any cross-subsidy going on within the DNR's budget in your fisheries operational costs of running the collection of the eggs? Is that being, you know, how are you going to be assured that you're going to be financially viable in that sector if you're not, in the end, actually raising and stocking fish? Do you get what my question is?
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scoy, somewhat. I think the main thing for people to realize is the fisheries, actually the Game of Fish division is almost completely funded off of Game of Fish fund dollars, license dollars. There's about $200,000 general fund of their entire budget. So those activities are being paid for by hunters and anglers and also through the walleye stamp and other dollars that are federal dollars and things like that. So we are paying our own way. People do pay their own way for this. The program itself is a very complicated one for us to walk through, and I encourage you to, if you have the time or if you're interested, to see our fish stocking, fish hatchery facilities and our fish taking operations. Actually, we have a DVD I can link you to as well. It's very complex, but we need to work with the private industry, as Mr. Bozak says. They provide us with a strong piece of our stocking tools, but the amendment here, I think, has some unintended consequences that we need to make sure everybody's aware of. The impacts to our taking program, our fish taking, our fry raising, and our fish stocking programs, as our staff has said as well. So we do have some concerns, and we need to work through this should it go on.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you. And Mr. Myers, so the egg collection is paid for out of the Game and Fish Fund through the sale of your fishing licenses. How are you going to assess the cost of those eggs to the private sector? That's what I'm trying to get at. How is all this going to play out?
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scoy, I think if you see on the amendment on lines 1.28 to 1.29, the commissioner may not, actually that whole section going up to 1.26, commissioner may not sell game, fish, fry, or eggs for less than the cost associated with the production of eggs or fry. We would be able to actually tell how much those costs of those operations are, what it costs us to produce that quart of eggs, and then determine that price. I think the main concern that we have is some of the language on 1.13, striking that up to 2% and inserting for every 86 pounds of walleye fingerlings contracted. So the more walleye fingerlings we buy, the more fry we have to supply to the private sector. We just need to work through the whole process that we're doing here. We did have a meeting with Mr. Bozak and some of his staff or his colleagues here a month and a half or 2 months ago to discuss how can we do these more cooperatively. Unfortunately, we're in the middle of a lawsuit or litigation with the walleye, the aquaculture industry, Department of Administration, and the DNR and the state about the pricing and contracting of the procurement of walleye fry, and it really limits our ability to have an open discussion with these folks. We want to have the best walleye stocking program we have and stock the best fish we can, and the state can't do it by itself, but how we get there, I'm not sure if this is the right way or not.
Mr. Chair, go ahead. Mr. Meyer, what's the status of the lawsuit? How much longer until that is going to be resolved, do you think?
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scoy, I have no idea. I mean, it's still in the discovery phase right now, I understand.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Langseth.
Mr. Chair, it kind of seems like this is a good thing to talk about now and think about, but probably come back next year and with more information and so on, and you'd probably feel a little more comfortable with that if you had a little more time to work it out.
Mr.
Mr. Chair, Senator Langseth, yeah, as I said, the unintended consequences or the impact of this amendment, seeing it for the first time this afternoon, I can't tell you that right now. And we do need more time to figure out how do we work together in more cooperative efforts, that's for sure.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Ingebretson.
Mr. Chair, I'm just going to take a stab at this this litigation without getting into trouble, I hope. I don't know if you can do that, actually, but my guess is there's a litigation here because over the years, at least the last 4 years that I've been here and talking with the private folks with regards to this issue is that they've been trying quite hard to move forward here, and that's not been happening, and I think that might be part of the reason. And again, I don't think I can dare comment any more than that, other than just my guess. So I think when you hear the private sector come in here and throw figures around like $16 will get you up to 20 fish per pound, and the DNR, and again, this can be disputed, I'm sure, is spending $23 for only 4 fish. I think we should really be paying attention to that. I think we should be probably looking at moving this forward, quite frankly, with those kind of numbers. And that's why I think just with this amendment here, it's going to get it off of square one and get moving in that direction. We can do whatever we want after we get the information, but I think what's happening here is we're kind of pushing the envelope a little bit, but not over the edge. Just get it moving here, and I think it probably hasn't been happening, and that's why we're sitting here now kind of at a stalemate.
Senator Kelash.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebretson, it seems like the legislature would be getting in the middle of a lawsuit that has a ways to go, and we'd be, in effect, maybe, I don't know if we'd call picking sides, but that's one of the things. It seems like this has been going on for a while, so waiting till further on or into the next session even is not going to be a huge burden, and we'll have more information. But trying to pass legislation where the DNR doesn't know how much it's going to cost, doesn't know what it's going to do to the lawsuit, inability to talk about it even because of the lawsuit, makes it pretty difficult to figure out what's going to end up happening with all of this. So I think we're better off just leaving the legislation alone until we have more information on it. So,
want to respond to that, Senator Ingebretson? No. Senator Higgins, what's next?
Senator Kelash said.
Okay.
Pretty much.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the reason that I'm so concerned about this is I was part of a pretty successful fish stocking effort on Red Lake. And I know that there are different amounts of sized fry or eggs or fish that they put in when they're stocking, depending upon the projected survival rates. And I don't have any idea why the DNR would be stocking a 4-pound fish as opposed to a fingerling. I don't know why that would be, but and from my recollection, fingerlings were pretty successful. But, you know, they did go up to Lake Vermilion and get the genetics for the Red Lake restocking. They used a special dye that they put in there so they could track those fish survival rates versus the native survival walleyes. It was really a very successful program. I mean, if we can get more fish fry cheaper doing the private sector, I think we would be supportive of that. But I think in an amendment at this point, we don't have answers to those questions. It makes me a little nervous. So I don't know exactly where we want to go with this. But, you know, we do have a pretty good track record in Minnesota of stocking. Certainly in Red Lake they did. And they wouldn't want to see us interfering in those efforts.
Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Where would this bill go after Is there another stop? Does this go to finance or
state government?
To state government. I'm just wondering if that doesn't give maybe the people a chance to work out some of that language or differences or whatever between now and then, rather than I guess I would be a little bit uneasy to jump on something too right away with just springing it on. I'd give the private folks a chance to work out some things with the DNR before the next stop.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to that point, Senator Carlson, it's going to have at least one more stop and maybe two from here. I guess my feeling is that I'm just talking with the assistant commissioner and being it does have a couple stops, we can look at the numbers here. I guess what I'd like to see is I'd like to see it at least move out of here and keep that conversation going. Now, I will tell you that if I'm totally convinced that this is not the direction to go, I'll be the first to jump in and say we're not going to do it. But I think what's happened is we just came to, it seems like the private folks that have been dealing with the DNR, and I think in a good way for a lot of years, is now come up against a wall here. And unfortunately, we have this lawsuit here now. And I'm not saying that's why we have the lawsuit, but it might have something to do with it. I don't know. I can't say that. But it just seems to me that by moving this forward, I think we as a group will be sending a message, I think, to both sides that we want to do the right thing. And I want to do the right thing. I'm certainly not going to go off and if it's cost prohibitive to do that and we're better off where we're at, then I certainly would look at dropping at a later time before one of the next committees. So, and a four-pound walleye seems to be a fryer to me, Senator Scoy. I think you're right. I agree with you on that. Yeah, that's a fryer.
Senator Langstaff.
Mr. Chair, it seemed like it shouldn't pass out of this committee until we're firmly convinced that it is the right thing to do and not just put it on a more comprehensive bill because it might be the right thing to do. I just think we should hold this up and I'm not for it or against it. I just want to know more about it, and I think this committee should know more about it before they put it, particularly before they put it on another bill and send it out.
Senator Scoy?
What's Senator Ingebrigtsen? What are you planning on having a vote on the A5 amendment real shortly now?
Yes, as Senator Gazelka's amendment.
Senator Gazelka, yeah. I'm sorry. I want to offer an amendment to the amendment. I would on page 1, line 12, reinstate the stricken language. And remove the new language.
Mr. Knopf, do you understand that?
Mr. Chairman, I think if I heard him correctly, it's on line 1.12, reinstate the stricken language and delete the new language.
That's the amendment.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Could I have Mr. Knopf give us the consequences of that? Well, from his legal mind?
Mr. Chair and members, the difference is that the commissioner would not be required to do that. It wouldn't be required to offer that. Under current law, it says the commissioner may offer, as eggs or fry, up to 2% of the department's annual game fish and egg. This would take off the 2% limit, put in barter, but it would keep in the may or authorize the commissioner to do it, but not require the commissioner to do it. As under current law,
I'd move that amendment to make this permissive as opposed to a requirement.
Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to see what the testifier input is on that.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Bozak.
Mr. Chair and members. As long as it's in there, may or shall, I mean, it's the opportunity that the DNR knows that as they privatize more the fingerling program, it's going to require more eggs, and fry for our needs. And as long as it's may and they're gearing down
their pond production of walleyes, I mean, it will gear up ours. So, I mean, may shall allow it to still happen. I mean, it's okay with us.
Okay. Be careful saying may shall allow here.
Yeah, may shall
that's
allow.
That's what we're talking about here is may or shall. Sounds like it'd be fine with the
yes.
Private.
Friendly amendment?
Yep.
Okay. All in favor of Senator Scoy's amendment?
To the amendment.
Everybody understand that? Say aye.
Aye.
Opposed nay? The ayes have it. Now we're back to the A5 amendment. Any more discussion? Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, and Senator Gazelka, can you explain the effect of deleting the sentence that starts on 1.21?
Let's see.
Why that would have to be taken out.
Mr. Knopf, would you explain
Mr.
that?
Mr. Knopf, yeah. All right.
Oh, it
Mr.
might be
Chair.
Best if I explain it. What that does, see, the walleye stamp right now says it's supposed to go for stocking. But it doesn't. The department is allowed to use its own resources for stocking. What this is changing now is that only money in the walleye stamp account may only be used to purchase walleyes from the private sector for stocking. And so paragraph B is not really needed anymore because they won't be it pretty much limits them to their own costs directly related to a specific body of water. So since they're only going to be acquiring fish from the private sector with that money, this just becomes kind of irrelevant in paragraph B.
Okay. Any other questions, members, or do you have more testimony, Mr. Ingebretson, Senator Ingebretson?
I don't have any unless there is some other. To the amendment, you mean?
Yes, to the amendment, A5.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Kelash.
I am waiting for his explanation.
Okay. Senator Mr. Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. And to Senator Scoy's previous motion, there is one more shall in the amendment that I think hopefully the committee could take as a friendly amendment as well. On line 1.31, where it says 1 quart of eggs or fry equivalent shall be offered for purchase or barter, I think in the intent of the last motion, hopefully we could incorporate that change as well, that shall to a may.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
I would move on page 1, line 31 to strike shall and insert may.
Would you like to speak to that? Senator Kelash? Okay, Senator Scoy.
Thank you. Well, Mr. Chair, I think that, you know, this keeps this issue alive as it moves through, as I heard some discussion about. It's not tying the commissioner's hands quite as tight, but certainly leaving the initiative as something that it appears this committee thinks he should be doing. And so I think it's a reasonable request, and hopefully the progress will be made.
Senator Gazelka.
Mr. Chair, I'm on state government too, so that if the two parties involved are still having a problem, I'm very aware of the issue we're dealing with. So unless the testifier is adamantly opposed, I would consider this friendly.
Okay. Senator Kelash.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, the shall is part of it, but my question is, do we really want to put a 86 pounds per quart of eggs in legislation, thereby tying the DNR's hands if, you know, maybe they could get by with 50 pounds of fingerlings for a quart, or the opposite way, you know, they could they could get 100 pounds of fish. I mean, we're kind of dictating negotiations and legislation. So that seems to tie the DNR's hands on that completely. So I realize we're on a delete shell, but I just didn't see the whole be eliminated.
Mr. Meyer, do you want to speak to that?
Mr. Chair, I heard 100 and 200 from some of my colleagues, but I understand the concern, Senator Kelash, and I really appreciate it. I think we're okay at this point in time with the 86 and working with the industry and Senator Gazelka and others to try to figure out what this should be. As long as it's permissive right now, we can massage it a little bit. The intent of the amendment is one that we understand and need to continue working on just to make our fisheries a better place. So I don't think at this point we need to burn up more valuable committee time debating on what 86 or 100 or what that number should be, but we'll work with other with members here and the chairman to figure out if that number is needed or what it should be and things like that.
Mr. Bozak.
Mr. Chair and members, the 86 is just a number that we were just going off of the state's production and how much fry they use to get to that production. It's just a number. The thing we're concerned about is the same thing the state is. The state wants to make sure that if they give us this fry, that we're going to replace fingerlings into the state of Minnesota and not sell them fish out of state. And that's why we were concerned about putting something in there that just says, hey, yeah, we want to make sure that these fish go into Minnesota and you're not supplying the whole United States. You know, and that's a concern of ours as well as states. And that's why we put that language in there. You know, so we whether it's 86 or not, it's something's got to be in there that we're selling the fish back to the state of Minnesota and not taking them elsewhere.
Senator Skoy, you have an amendment to the amendment. Is that correct on line 1.31?
I would renew my motion to strike shell and insert A.
Okay. Senator Skoy has moved to strike shell and move in May instead. All in favor of that amendment, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. The ayes have it. Okay, we're back to the A5 amendment.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the A5 amendment as amended.
Okay.
Renew my motion.
He's renewed his motion, Senator Gazelka, to move the A5 amendment. Any more discussion? No. Any more discussion on the A5 amendment? As amended. Thank you. Okay. All in favor of the A5 amendment as amended, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. The ayes have it. Yes, Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have the A2 amendment.
Okay, we'll get the A2 amendment passed out.
And, Mr. Chair, if I might, while that's being passed out, I'll explain very quickly.
Yep.
What this amendment would do, members, is to change the requirement on bear baiting stations to kind of mirror the requirements on a fish house, if you will. Right now, you have the option on a nice fishing house to either put your name and address or your driver's license number or your Minnesota DNR number on as an identification piece. And all this is doing is giving that same option. So, and this actually was brought to me by one of my constituents whose wife is a bear hunter. And he says, I really don't like the idea of my wife's name and address being on a bucket out in the middle of the woods. And he said, why couldn't we just use the Minnesota DNR number like we do on many other things, like on deer stands, fish houses, ice fish houses, et cetera. And I thought it sounded like a good idea, and I do believe that the DNR was in favor of this change also. Just gives a little more flexibility for identification on bear bait stations.
Any discussion on the A2 amendment? Senator Gerlach.
Chairman, I think we're missing a word on it. I think your intent is not to include all three, but any of the three. Is that correct?
Right. The word or on line 1.9.
But, Chairman, and Senator Carlson, the way it
yes.
reads is the tag displayed at each site where bait is placed must contain 1, 2, or 3.
Or 3 notes.
So you have to say the tag at each site where bait is placed must contain either 1, 2, or 3.
Don't you
either
end?
Is that good enough?
No.
You're an
English
teacher? No.
She's right.
Okay, Chairman, I just didn't know.
Thank you, Senator Gerlach. Anybody else? Senator Carlson, did you raise your hand? No. Any other comments or testimony for A2 amendment?
Mr. Chair, the DNR is looking at it right now. I'd like to give them a chance to comment on it one way or the other.
you have any?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we're fine with the amendment.
Okay. Good. Okay, Senator Carlson moves the 8-2 amendment. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay? The ayes have it. The 8-2 amendment is passed. Any more amendments? Senator Skoy.
Thank you. I have an oral amendment that I'd like to offer on page 20, line 26. I would like to strike "and the vehicle's engine is shut off." I just think there's going to be lots of confusion with regard to this. I think if they're 10 feet from the vehicle, that ought to be good enough.
So you're striking "and the vehicle engine is shut off"?
I would move to strike on page 20, line 26, "and the vehicle's engine is shut off." Strike that.
Okay, any discussion on that? Senator Ingebrigtsen?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, on line 20.26, you said?
That's correct.
Vehicle engine is shut off. Is that what, I'm sorry,
yes.
Senator Skoy. Maybe Mr. Knopf, you'd repeat it for everybody.
Well, yep.
Mr. Knopf.
Mr. Chairman, on line 20.26, Senator Skoy is offering to delete "and the vehicle's engine is shut off." And let me just explain what that would do. Under this provision, you have to be at least 10 feet from a motor vehicle before shooting the grouse. And so under the current provision of the bill, it would have to be 10 feet over, and you have to turn the vehicle off. This would allow you to have the vehicle running, but you'd still have to move 10 feet from the vehicle before. You could turn it off if you want to, but you would have to be at least 10 feet from the vehicle to take the shot at the grouse.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, is there any problem with a vehicle running without someone in it?
I don't think so. I think it's a good amendment.
All right. Okay, any other discussion? Seeing none, the chair moves. I'm sorry, Senator Skoy moves to remove the section on line 20.26, "and the vehicle engine is shut off." All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. The ayes have it. Back to the Senate file. Any other discussion, or we better get back to testimony?
You're done, aren't you? Are you complete?
We have a walk.
Yeah. Mr. Mueller, you have something.
I just want to point out one fiscal issue on this. I have a fiscal note on it, but it mainly only pertains to Section 25, the allowing the DNR to charge. Currently, they charge $2 for when they issue a stamp, and this, the language on 25 says they should only charge what the actual cost is for producing it and sending it out. This would actually lower a little bit of game and fish revenue, so they must apparently overcharge right now. So by about, they're estimating $37,000 or $38,000 per year less would go into the game and fish fund from Section 25. But it would be a savings to people buying the stamps.
Right. Okay, let's go on to testimony then.
Mr. Chair, if I yes. might just ask the committee if they'd like the DNR to go through the whole bill, or have they perused it enough to move forward?
Anybody? Yes, Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I guess I just have a question about this last provision about the stamp. Not having served on the Environment Committee for a number of years, I'm not fully versed maybe on the purpose of these stamps, but my understanding is the purpose of the stamp is more than just to cover the cost of the stamp. It's also to do, in the eventually do some habitat enhancement. and a lot of people buy the stamps just kind of to support that habitat enhancement. And if we make this change where the stamp is only going to cover the cost of issuing the stamp, et cetera, don't we lose that habitat enhancement component somewhat? And I don't know if the DNR wants to address that or the author or somebody, but it just seems to me that maybe this change is something that we might not need to do.
Senator Mueller. Mr. Mueller.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Skoy, the only change that's being made in the bill is the cost of issuing the stamp. The same additional costs, like for the duck stamp and pheasant stamp, that goes into those accounts doesn't change. So the additional costs, I even forget what the waterfall stamp is, for the base stamp itself won't change. It's just the issuing cost of the stamp. They want to be allowed to have a flexibility of having a different charge for the issuing and the production of the stamp, but not the habitat part of the stamp.
Oh, okay. I guess I didn't understand that.
Okay. Anybody else like to speak, or would they like the DNR to go through the bill?
If not, Mr. Chair, I would move Senate File 943 as amended.
Okay. Senator Ingebrigtsen moves 940, Senate File 943 as amended. Any discussion?
To pass to state.
Yes, to pass to State Government Innovation. Then all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The ayes have it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, and I think we have to be out of here in a half an hour. So Senator Gazelka's got a bill. And
there was only two signatures on the conference report. We should just leave. We should just leave.
This isn't like a budget.
I got
a ranger party to go to.
And if there's something,
Mr. Chair,
Senator Gazelka,
this is Senate File 1106. I can tell you that members of the All Terrain Vehicle Association of Minnesota and the Amateur Riders Motorcycle Association from District 23 brought this provision of this bill to my attention. Motorized recreation is important to the people of my district, the Brainerd area, and I think across the state as well. But this bill will do a few things. It will ensure riding opportunities remain open. Parents can properly teach their children to ride. Right now you can't ride on the back of a four-wheeler, but we have provisions in here so the parent could with a younger rider. It reduces the burden of local governments to renew on road ordinances annually. Finally, the bill allows owners of off-highway motorcycles the opportunity to equip their motorcycles with proper road safety equipment and use them on roads after inspection by a police officer. But Jonathan Bowen of Media Government is to explain the bill further, but I do have an author's amendment that I would like to move, the A1.
Okay. Senator Gazelka moves the A1 amendment. Do you want to explain that?
I can if you'd like first. This one, again, this amendment is a change to the definition of all-terrain vehicles. In three of the last 4 years, the definition of ATV has needed to be changed as machines continue to change. Instead of continuing to change the statute of ATV, AM, and DNR, and a major manufacturer have joined together to create a comprehensive new definition. So the DNR is on board with this as well. Hopefully, we'll not have to keep changing this. The compromise language deletes the current engine displacement requirement and instead adds width of the machine. The weight limits are kept in the definitions as they are now to protect the sustainability of trails. So that's the A1 amendment.
Okay. Any discussion on the A1 amendment?
We want to adopt it anyway because it's the author's amendment. But
yeah. Okay. Hearing none, all in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. A1 amendment is adopted. Senator Gazelka.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I can have Mr. Bone
describe the details if you need to any more. We'd be happy to do that.
Welcome, Mr. Bone. Identify yourself, if you would, please, and continue with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Jonathan Bone. I am here today representing the All Terrain Vehicle Association of Minnesota and the Amateur Riders Motorcycle Association, District 23. We are the user groups for the All Terrain Vehicle and dirt bikers in the state. I just want to briefly walk through the provisions in the bill, and I will stand for questions at the end if there are any. Beginning with Section 1, Section 1 deletes the line that currently gives the Commissioner of DNR the authority to establish an OHV season by order. This was passed in 2007 to deal with a problem that was the original driving force behind the language was recreational riding during deer hunting rifle season. In working with DNR officials and with user groups, we were able to establish and pass into statute last year restrictions on recreational riding in state forests during the rifle deer hunting season. So we feel that this language opens us up to possible closure of forests by a commissioner that decides to do an order without any input from the legislature or from the user groups or other concerned parties. So it just deletes that one line. Section 2 allows for off-highway motorcycles that have been properly equipped with mirrors, a headlight, and a taillight to be licensed for on-road use. The Department of Public Safety will then create a form that is to be filled out by the motorcycle owner and signed by an officer that completes an inspection of the safety equipment. Section 3 allows for parents and legal guardians to ride as a passenger on an ATV that is driven by their child. Currently, no children aged 12 to 17 are allowed to have any passengers on the machine. This provision simply allows for a parent or legal guardian to ride on the machine as a passenger. We're hoping that it will allow parents an opportunity to teach their children how to properly use the machine before they're riding on their own. Section 4 adds the definition of off-highway motorcycle from Section 2 into the definition of motor vehicle. Section 5 amends a statute that was identified by public safety as an obstacle to registering OHMs because they were unsure that some OHMs would satisfy the emissions requirements. The intent of this section is to make the section apply only to titled vehicles, not registered vehicles. Section 6, beginning on line 4.17, deletes an old definition of ATV and replaces it with the statutory citation, so it remains current with the constant changing of ATV definitions, which hopefully we've taken care of with the author's amendment. On line 4.15, you will also see the words four-wheel stricken, as some ATVs do not have four wheels. The same language fix is seen in Section 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12. Section 7 reduces the burden on local governments that have passed an ordinance allowing certain ATV use on their roads to renew their permit every 3 years instead of each year. Section 8 changes the times of operation language to allow ATVs with the proper road riding safety equipment, headlights, taillights, and brake lights to be operated in the dark. However, with this provision, local governments still have the authority to restrict access at nighttime in their ordinance. Sections 9, 10, 11, and 12 are all the language I spoke of previously, which delete the words four-wheel when citing all-terrain vehicles. And quickly on the author's amendment. The amendment is a compromise worked on by DNR Parks and Trails Enforcement. Three ATV manufacturers, including both of the major manufacturers in Minnesota, and also the user group. We're concerned at the constant changing of the machines and having to come back to the legislature every year, having to change the definition to meet the new machine that's out. What we'd like to do with this language is simply a comprehensive change that will allow us to more broadly define ATV to fit some of the new ideas the manufacturers have come up with, while at the same time protecting the sustainability of the trails and of the forests.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee?
Senator Gazelka, would you like to move to Karen Umpress?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Thanks. I'm Karen Umpress. I'm Amateur Riders Dirt Bike Associate, Amateur Riders Motorcycle Association, or the Dirt Bike. We're also District 23 of the American Motorcycle Association. American Motorcyclist Association.
It's a mouthful, is it?
Yeah, all of it.
Well, welcome to the committee.
Thanks. And mostly I'm just going to say I'm here for any questions regarding the dual sport licensing, but I wanted to give the members an idea of what a dual sport motorcycle is. Most motorcycles are either street bikes or dirt bikes. A street bike is just what it sounds like. It's made to travel on paved highways. Dirt bike is something that you usually ride on trails. A dual sport is a motorcycle that mostly rides on gravel roads, but it does have the ability to ride on some paved, and it has the ability to ride on some trails. So people who ride dual sports are generally people who are just out for a casual ride on a lot of gravel roads, like the gravel roads that you'll find in rural communities along rivers, off of scenic highways. So it's a very casual type of a ride. And the population is growing. It's also called adventure riding because you're on gravel, and most street bike riders can't stand any gravel or any pebbles in the road. So that's why it's called adventure riding. Then if anybody has any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer them.
Any questions, members? hearing none, Senator Gazelka.
I don't know if there's any other
testimony. Excuse me, I should ask. Are there any other folks in the audience that would like to testify either to or from against the bill? Seeing none?
Well, Mr. Chair, I move Senate File 1106 as amended.
And from here to transportation?
Sounds good. Thank you.
Any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Bill passes. Members, that's it for today. Thank you very much for the time. And we stand adjourned.
Now we spent a fair amount of time on the